And the Radio Derb is on the air. Greetings, faithful listeners. This is, of course, your eruditely genial host, John Derbyshire, with our customary roundup of the week's news. First, there is a somewhat unpleasant matter to clear up. Some listeners have grumbled that my commentary on Radio Derb is occasionally marred by a taint of salacity via the technique known to our Gaelic cousins as double entendre. I have, these listeners aver, I have been especially guilty of these delinquencies when discussing the situation of Mrs. Derbyshire, who is holding the fort over there in Long Island with no one but Miguel the pool boy to help with household chores. And also when making asides about my diligent and superbly well-educated young research assistants, Amanda, Candace and Brunhilde, to give them their full birth names, who, from sheer professionalism, sacrificed the art galleries and opera houses of New York City for the beaches, olive groves, warm waters and yacht parties out here in our Aegean exile.
I'm like, cut it out. And he's like, am I embarrassing you? And I'm like, can we stop? And he's like, I saw you come in. And I'm like, okay. And he's like, can I get your drink?
Girls, could you keep it down over there? Thanks. I indignantly reject these accusations of salacity via double entendres. Those who know me will be glad to tell you that I hold the female of our species in the highest regard. I am the very soul of chivalry, a perfect Sir Galahad towards the weaker sex. Is that not so, girls?
Of course!
The double entendre is a style of diction utterly alien to my frank and direct nature. Now that I've cleared that up, let's proceed with the broadcast. Mandy, when you have a moment free, my dear, do you think you could help me out here? I dressed in rather a hurry this morning, I'm afraid. My sock needs tucking. So, how are we getting on at resolving the fiscal crisis? Not too well. Badly enough, in fact, to keep alive a spark of hope that congressional Republicans will, in fact, get up off their knees and walk away from the whole silly show. There is only one thing this nation's economy needs, and that is a big reduction in federal spending. We sure won't get that from Barack Obama. Spending is Obama's middle name. Or it would be if his middle name wasn't something else. He's actually demanding more money for federal government programs, $1.6 trillion more. In his November 28th speech, Obama threatened that, quote, if Congress does nothing, every family in America will see their taxes automatically go up at the beginning of next year. Starting January 1st, every family in America will see their taxes go up. A typical middle-class family of four would see its income taxes go up by $2,200. End quote. Well, speaking for my own middle-class family of four, I say, bring it on. It's a pretty good rule of economic sanity that you should pay for what you get, to an amount at least as much as the thing costs. If middle-class Americans want all these federal programs, well, let them damn well pay for them. We've gotten into the mess we're in by pretending you can have things without paying for them. Let's drive a wooden stake through that great collective illusion. You want Medicare for your grandma and granddad? Pay for it. You want tens of thousands of soldiers in Germany, Italy, Japan and Korea? Pay for them. You want federal bailouts for union-whipped auto manufacturers and too big to fail financial institutions? Pay for them. You want billions in foreign aid, farm subsidies, high-speed rail, refugee resettlement, the Pigford scam, contraceptives for university students, gun-running operations to Mexican bandits, protection for spotted owls, and crackpot education schemes that promise to make dumb kids smart? You want those things? Well then, pay for them, damn it. If you don't want those things, why do you vote for politicians who keep them alive? In particular, why did the majority of you vote for Barack Obama? Bring it on! If the great American public wants their federal government to spend another $1.6 trillion, let's raise the revenue to pay for it. Where from? From the great American public. Where did you think? The revenue fairy? Yes, that's pretty much what people have been thinking the past few decades. Our country is knee-deep in debt because we haven't been earning to pay for what we've been getting. Instead, we've been borrowing to pay for it. When you borrow money, it eventually comes due, principal and interest. The British and French governments borrowed a ton of money from the USA to pay for World War I. In the 20s, when the repayments were getting to be onerous, it was suggested to President Calvin Coolidge that the debts be forgiven, or scaled down, or at least restructured. Coolidge replied in the negative. When pressed, he said, immortal quote, "They hired the money, didn't they?" We've been hiring a whole lot of money, and it's time we dropped the habit. The nation wanted Obama. Well, they got him. Now let's pay for him. I spoke there of a spark of hope that congressional Republicans might do the right thing, which would be to go home and disconnect their telephones. It is, of course, only the tiniest spark. The Congress critters, Democrats and Republicans alike, are just as addicted to spending as Obama is. It's not just Obama squeezing away at the teats of the taxpayer cow. It's him and Congress both, though they may differ somewhat in squeeze technique. As a percentage of gross domestic product, federal spending in fiscal 2012 was 24.33%, higher than in any previous year since 1946, when it was 29.94%. Got that? Winding up World War II and preparing to face down the Soviets, just short of 30%. Winding up a tiny colonial skirmish in West Asia and facing down a few hundred fanatics with box cutters, 25%. It's not just Obama, it's also Congress. Which means, at one slight remove, it's us. We want the goodies, but we don't want to pay for them. This is, not to put too fine a point on it, this is immoral. We hired the money, and if we don't pay for it, our children will have to. I love my kids. I want them to have good lives in a country that conducts its fiscal affairs with honour and good sense. I'll pay. But for goodness sake, let's not ratchet up the spending even further on this president's stupid, bogus, quote, investment in training, education, science and research. So what will actually happen with these fiscal cliff negotiations? Shall my spark of hope burst out into glorious flame? Not likely. John Boehner is a spineless twerp, and few House Republicans are any better. Like Britain's high tax, high spending, open borders, unnecessary wars, multiculturalist, globalist Tory party, the GOP has entered a death spiral. This recent election knocked them off their feet, but it was like knocking down a 95-year-old guy on a Zimmer frame. Barack Obama will get the deal he wants, more or less, because his opposition doesn't have a full set of vertebrae between them. Obama knows this, of course, and he's openly mocking us. News report from the Weekly Standard blog, December 4th. Quote, President Barack Obama met with several MSNBC hosts this afternoon at the White House to discuss tax rates, according to Huffington Post reporter Jennifer Bendery. The reporter wondered if an MSNBC love fest was going on at the White House. End quote. Named in the report as having been summoned by the president to offer their fiscal advice were Rachel Maddow, Lawrence O'Donnell, and Reverend Al Sharpton. In related news, John Boehner has been seeking advice on the nation's fiscal management from Snooki, Pee Wee Herman, and Pastor Terry Jones. Listeners, shed a tear for our beautiful country that has come to such a pass. Then, get ready to pay what you owe. A nation gets the government it deserves, and this is the one we got. Cynicism does not get a good press in the USA. There have been some great American cynics. H.L. Mencken, Ambrose Bierce, Mark Twain in his darker moments. But this is, on the whole, an optimistic, romantic nation. Our moving spirit is Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who taught that human nature is fundamentally good and is only diverted into the evils of greed, selfishness, and a dozen bad words ending in ism by the corrupting influences of bourgeois civilization. The old Adam keeps breaking through the smiley face mask, though, and the daily diet of stories from the news media always contains a few items to make us cynics cackle with cynical glee. This week's news turned up a real doozy in that line. The central characters here are, first, Lawrence DiPrimo, a New York City cop, and second, Jeffrey Hillman, a street person aged 54. On the cold night of November 14th, Officer DiPrimo was on foot patrol in Times Square. He saw Mr. Hillman sitting on the sidewalk, propped against a wall, and noticed that Mr. Hillman's feet were bare. Officer DiPrimo did the Good Samaritan thing. He went to a local store and, with his own money, purchased a pair of boots and a pair of socks and went back out and put them on Mr. Hillman's feet. A passing tourist caught the episode on her camera phone and sent it to the New York Police Department. Her recording of the incident was unknown to Officer DiPrimo at the time, and it was definitely unknown to Mr. Hillman, who appears comatose. The NYPD put the pictures online, and Officer DiPrimo became a national hero. Pretty soon he was doing the talk show circuit. By last weekend, he could have run for mayor. In fact, given the menagerie of tinfoil hat lefties who are running for mayor, many of us wished he would. It was a pretty little story, but to us cynics, it was surprising from a couple of angles. For one, this was a cop doing this. There is hardly any profession where you'll find a higher concentration of cynicism than in police work. Cops don't read Jean-Jacques Rousseau. They don't need to. They have philosophy lessons every working day of the week. If you want to see human nature as cops see it, I recommend Connie Fletcher's book, What Cops Know. My surprise here was muted somewhat when I learned that Officer De Primo is a rookie, only 25 years old. Still, even at that age, he can have been out patrolling the streets for 2 or 3 years, so the incident still bespeaks an exceptional innocence of heart. For another thing, this was New York City, where the normal friendly greeting to a stranger is, "Hey, jackass!" And you're either getting elbowed off the sidewalk or you're doing the elbowing. Anything you care to say about cynicism can be raised to the second, third, and fourth power in New York City. Anyway, when I read the story, my inner cynic spoke up right away. Here's what he said. "Ha! As soon as that homeless guy sobers up enough to string two thoughts together, he'll sell those boots to buy more booze or crack." Deplorable of me, I know. It turns out, though, that I wasn't cynical enough. Perhaps in today's world, you can never be cynical enough. Now, I don't actually know that Mr. Hillman sold his boots for booze money, but the circumstantial evidence is mighty strong. To quote from Henry David Thoreau, as "When You Find a Fish in Your Milk." I do know, because last Sunday's New York Times reported it, that Mr. Hillman is still wandering the New York streets and is once again barefoot. Tackled by the Times reporter, Mr. Hillman had this to say, quote, "Those shoes are hidden. They are worth a lot of money. I could lose my life." End quote. Mr. Hillman also had a grievance to air. Who doesn't in our republic of resentment? Quote, "I was put on YouTube. I was put on everything without permission. What do I get? This went around the world and I want a piece of the pie." End quote. Leaving aside Mr. Hillman's grievance that all he got from the affair was a lousy $100 set of boots and socks, what does he mean by saying, "I could lose my life"? I've been walking around New York City for 40 years, often in pricey footwear, but I've never felt my life was in danger therefrom. So perhaps Mr. Hillman's fears for his life refer to the denizens of the anarchic homeless shelter in which the poor fellow is obliged to spend his sleepless nights. Well, not likely. Here's where I wasn't cynical enough. You see, it turns out that Mr. Hillman is not actually homeless. New York's Channel 4 News reported on Tuesday that Veterans Affairs gave Mr. Hillman an apartment in the Bronx last year. City officials confirmed that he does actually live there. He pays his rent using, quote, a lifetime voucher for homeless veterans, together with his Social Security income, end quote. They don't explain why Mr. Hillman's getting Social Security at age 54. Presumably this is SSI, Supplemental Security Income, which was created in 1974 to help people not old enough for Social Security, but too disabled to work. SSI is now a vast scam, feeding taxpayer cash to anyone who can persuade a doctor to sign a note, with unscrupulous attorneys skimming off the cream. A friend who is a tad less cynical than myself suggested that perhaps panhandling in Times Square is just more profitable if you're barefoot, as indeed Officer De Primo's actions would illustrate. So possibly Mr. Hillman just leaves his boots at home when doing his night job. I don't know. Whatever the fate of those boots, the takeaway here is that our nation is planted thick from coast to coast with welfare programs like SSI, SSD, that's a different one, Veterans Affairs, SNAP, WIC, EBT, Medicaid, Section 8, school lunches and the rest, all funded out of your taxes. Any time you feel like spending money to help some homeless person on the street, just stop a moment and remember that you already gave at the office, which you surely did, at the IRS office, that is. It's been a while since there was an immigration item in the news for me to froth and sputter at. This week, delivered a couple. I'll tackle the big one here and defer the lesser one to my closing miscellany. This concerns the STEM Jobs Act, which passed the House of Representatives last Friday and came up before the Senate this week. STEM, it's an acronym, S-T-E-M, stands for Science, Technology, Engineering and Math. High points of the Act. It, one, eliminates the so-called Diversity Visa Program. This monumentally stupid program, another demon spawn of the late Senator Edward Kennedy, may he be suffering all the worst torments of hell, set aside 55,000 permanent resident visas for people from all over the world selected by lottery. Around 50% of the winners come from Africa, 30% from Europe, the rest from Asia, Australasia, and elsewhere in the Western Hemisphere. It, number two, awards that same number, 55,000, of permanent resident visas to foreigners graduating with doctor's or master's degrees in STEM subjects from US universities, if they agree to work in their STEM field for at least 5 years. And, number three, it contains provisions to speed up entry for spouses and children of permanent legal residents, among whom much the biggest category are Mexicans. The STEM Jobs Act is a Republican initiative, an aspect of the Republican desire to feed cheap labour to their business sponsors and funders. There is no evidence whatsoever that the USA has any shortage of STEM graduates. What would count as evidence would be rising salaries in these fields. Salaries overall are in fact falling, largely because these fields have already been flooded with foreign workers. It's not hard for a foreign graduate to get a job offer if he's willing to work for a low salary. As foreignization depresses salaries, STEM careers become less appealing to Americans, who go to law school instead. I watched the whole thing happen in my own former profession, commercial IT. As a mainframe programmer in the USA 40 years ago, I worked with teams of American programmers, all of them citizens from working class or lower middle class backgrounds, with ancestries that were Irish or Italian, Anglo or German, Jewish or black. It was a good middle-class career for a citizen. Now, foreignization has killed that opportunity, and Americans have responded in the rational way, by shunning computer science courses. To illustrate the issue, cast your eye down the graduate student roster for Caltech's Department of Electrical Engineering. It's reproduced on the website ee2.caltech.edu/people/gradstudents.html. And again in a December 4th post on vdare.com. There are 96 graduate students listed on that Caltech list. I have no way of knowing how many of them are non-citizens, but just based on the names, I'm guessing it's a lot. 16 of the 96 games are of obvious British, German, Italian or other European origin. That's 1/6. The others are all Indian, Chinese, Korean or Middle Eastern. Assuming a further 16 of these non-European names belong to citizens, that would leave 2/3 of the class as foreign, which I think is a fair guess. So that's the Republicans' STEM Act. It's crafted to balance out various interests. Eliminate the diversity lottery, which just swells Democrat voter rolls. Residence visas for STEM graduates, which satisfies the cheap labour lobbies that fund the GOP. And speed up chain migration for legal residence families. To do that reaching out to Hispanics that the Republicans are always being urged to do, mostly by their enemies, but they're too stupid to notice that. Congressional Democrats have their own immigration bill, and as is the silly custom now, it too has an acronym. It's the BRAINS Act. That's BRAINS, which stands for Benefits to Research and American Innovation Through Nationality Statutes. It's pretty much the same as the GOP bill, except it doesn't eliminate the diversity lottery. The Dems love that diversity lottery, because the people it brings in are mostly uneducated and low-skilled, which is to say, future Democrat voters. The BRAINS Act is the brainchild of New York's Senator Chuck Schumer. Opposing the STEM Act in the Senate on Wednesday, Schumer said the Republicans' Act contained, quote, anti-immigrant language, presumably because it does not increase the number of immigrant visas. It awards 55,000 to the STEM graduates, remember, but it ends the 55,000 visa diversity lottery. BRAINS, on the other hand, also has the new STEM visas, but keeps the lottery. In fact, neither STEM nor BRAINS is anti-immigrant. What they both are, and what all immigration talk is at the level of congressional or mainstream media discussion, what they are is anti-American. When this country first put men in space in the 1960s, immigration levels had been exceptionally low for 40 years, thanks to the restrictive 1924 Act. There was no shortage of scientists and engineers. Today, we have twice as many citizens, 315 million people, a big enough pool of talent to supply all the expertise we need in every field. Employers don't want Americans, though, because foreigners will work for less money. The whole message of immigration talk from both parties is that Americans are no good. Foreigners are so much brighter, more industrious, more entrepreneurial. Having priced low-skilled Americans out of the bottom part of the labour market by allowing illegal Mexicans to flood in, Congress is now hard at work pricing the skilled middle class out of their jobs with insults like the STEM and BRAINS Acts. Here is my comprehensive, yes, comprehensive solution, which I'm sure will be enthusiastically received by both parties in Congress. The Systematically Crush America's Majority Act, known for short as the SCAM Act. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Where are you, Miss Eleni? Ah, here she comes. Imprimis. Here is Sinclair Community College in downtown Dayton, Ohio. It's some big place. Nearly 30,000 students with, of course, a deep commitment to diversity. Quote from Sinclair's website, quote, "The concept of diversity at Sinclair Community College encompasses the acceptance, inclusiveness, engagement, and mutual respect among students, faculty, staff, administrators, and members of the broader community." End quote. If you are wondering whether the po-faced apparatchiks who extrude that kind of bunkum ever reflect on how far into self-parody they have sunk, stop wondering. They don't. Well, a construction crew was digging up the road in the grounds of the college. They put up a sign that said, "Men Working." A college administrator of the Gyno-American persuasion saw the sign and had a fit of the vapours. After being revived with smelling salts, she lodged a complaint with the construction company. Once the outrage became known, the college was locked down. Several hundred trained grief counsellors were bussed in to help the students cope with their hurt feelings, and Eric Holder's Justice Department dispatched a team of investigators charged with identifying the civil rights violators. Nah, I just made that up, I think. What nobody seems to have noticed is that if there were no women in the construction crew, which is usually, though of course shamefully, the case, the sign was perfectly truthful. There were men working. Even if anyone had noticed this, though, I doubt it would have made a difference. When diversity is on the line, truth counts for nothing. Item: the shooting of black teenage delinquent Trayvon Martin by white Hispanic neighbourhood watch volunteer George Zimmerman in Florida last February brought out the very worst in our corrupt mainstream media. No pains were spared by mainstream journalists to portray the shooting as an anti-black crime motivated by race prejudice of a type characteristic of evil white Americans. What is actually characteristic of today's USA is the low-level race war being committed by blacks against whites and Asians, with hundreds of victims every year. Details can be found in the Department of Justice's crime statistics or on websites like blackracismandracehatred.blogspot.com. Where they can not be found is in the mainstream media, which suppresses them. Well, George Zimmerman is fighting back against the media goons. This Thursday, he filed a lawsuit against NBC TV for editing an audio tape of his 9/11 calls to make him sound racially prejudiced. His attorneys also released high-resolution police photographs of Zimmerman showing the head and face injuries he'd received from Martin. The state prosecutors, who are in cahoots with the media rats, had previously released only very low-quality images in which the injuries could not be clearly seen. Zimmerman's attorneys managed to force release of the originals a few weeks ago. This whole affair has been a shame and disgrace on the national media and on the elected officials of Florida. I hope George Zimmerman gets an 8-figure award and never has to work again. Item. Oh yes, I promised you a minor immigration story. Here it is. Onyango Obama, Barack Obama's uncle, has had his immigration case reopened. You'll recall that Mr. Obama was arrested for drunk driving in August last year. He is an illegal immigrant. He'd been ordered deported in 1989. He'd appealed the order. He'd had his appeal turned down in 1992. And then he'd just stayed anyway. Following his DUI arrest last August, Obama had been given a stay of deportation until June 5th this year, so that his court case could be dealt with. It was. June 5th came and went. He's still here. It now looks as though this drunk driving scofflaw will be here for good, like Obama's aunt. Although in his favour it must at least be said that unlike Aunt Zaituni, he isn't living off welfare. Why such special treatment for this illegal immigrant lawbreaker? Why do you think? Next time anyone tries to tell you that ours is a nation of laws, not of men, you have my authority to sock him on the jaw. Item. Finally, a sad story from New Mexico. 81-year-old Luciano Mares of that state found a mouse in his home. Being not well disposed towards mice, Mr. Mares threw the rodent outside into a pile of leaves that he was burning in his backyard. The mouse, its poor fur all afire, escaped from the leaf pile and ran back into the house. The house thereupon caught fire and burnt to the ground. Mr. Mares escaped unharmed, but is now homeless. The Daily Caller, where I found this story, tells us that the present whereabouts of the mouse is unknown. So, apparently there is a god, and he's a mouse. Way over my time allowance, as usual, ladies and gents. I really must attempt to restrain my loquacity. To see us out, and to keep Radio Derb in good standing with the higher powers, here is the fine old Scottish actor Donald Douglas reading Robert Burns' poem, To a Mouse. I've edited it down to four stanzas. For the full poem, see johndarbyshire.com under Readings. More from Radio Derb next week.
We sleek it, coor and timorous beastie. Oh, what a panic's in thy breastie. Thou needna stir to war sae hasty with bicker and brattle. I would be laith to run and chase thee with murder and pattle. I'm truly sorry man's dominion has broken nature's social union and justifies that ill opinion which makes thee startle at me, thy poor earth-born companion and fellow mortal. But, Mousie, thou art no thy lane in proving foresight may be vain. The best-laid schemes, o mice and men, gang aft aglay, and leave us naught but grief and pain for promised joy. Still thou art blessed compared with me. The present only toucheth thee, but, och, I backward cast my ee on prospects drear, and forward, though I canna see, I guess and fear.